We have a quorum here, yes. We were going to try to have the public hearing, but since they're not here, Bob, I guess we ought to... Or are they here? Are they? Wilford.
Let's part.
Did you tell the MPO that I understand there's some watermen outside? Did you mean outside on the street or? Tell them we're going to have the oyster hearing first and then finish the. There's no way to do that to you, Ty. All right, Jack. Item 16 for the And then after that, we'll go back to the habitat.
Last month, Dr. Wesson presented a very detailed description of the request of the industry to open the lower Rappahannock River and to allow hand scraping in portions of the James River. He described in detail the staff's opposition to those two proposals, and we weren't going to go back through that lengthy presentation again this month. He has prepared a brief summary of his comments that are at the front of the evaluation you've been given on this item. That highlights the major concerns that staff has. And when I finish, he does have a very brief PowerPoint presentation that he can take you through to refresh your memories on this. These are very important issues to staff, and I think they're difficult issues for you at times, mostly because with all of our decisions with respect to oyster restoration, we are dealing with two objectives that often appear to be in conflict but don't have to be in conflict. The two objectives that you deal with are, first and foremost, the ecological restoration of the oyster resource in Virginia. The second objective, however, that you often try to achieve is some maintenance of the industry and its infrastructure and markets while the restoration process is underway. There are times when there is a need to do things to restore the resource ecologically, and there are times when there are needs to help the industry stay in business so that they'll still be there when the oyster resource is recovered. Unfortunately, there are times when we have before us situations like we have now that involve undoing what was done to ecologically restore the resource with the idea that that will provide some benefits to the industry. And I think that's what we have in this case. We have two areas that are ecologically very, very important. Some would say they're unique along the Atlantic coast, perhaps in the United States. And so staff is very strongly holds that you should not open these areas. In doing so, you would take away our efforts to ecologically restore the resource to benefit the industry, and we prefer you not do that. Down the road, there are things we can do for industry to help them that we do every year. For instance, we purchase all of the house shell in the state from oyster houses. That money is important for them to maintain their businesses from year to year. And, of course, it provides us with a valuable product that can be planted in various locations for oyster restoration. So that's an example of something that has a dual purpose. It meets both objectives. And those are the kinds of things we want to pursue in the future. We don't think that these two proposals are examples of those. Secondly, staff would like to propose that you do something to help industry today, and that is to extend the current oyster season in the James River by an additional 30 days by emergency regulation within the areas that are currently open to harvest. As you know, the Tangier area, is also open and already will remain open through February. The Hantong areas in the James River will continue to be open until April 30th and could potentially be extended at that date by administratively. But here today we would suggest that you go ahead and extend the season in the lower James River for an additional 30 days. And then finally, and Jim mentioned this last month in his presentation, he noted that much of what staff has done and has brought to you for approval over the last almost 12 to 15 years, is a result of the recommendations of a Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel that was created back in the early 90s that described what was then a new approach to oyster restoration. In our view, we think it's time to convene a workshop, if you will, of management and science and industry to reevaluate the recommendations of the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel, to look at where we have had successes relative to that panel's work and where we have had failures, and reevaluate the whole process and start to very clearly look at the two objectives that I have described and develop programs to achieve both of those objectives, making sure that whatever we do, we inform the public that in one case, what we were doing is designed to meet the one objective, and in another case, it might be designed to meet the first objective, so that there's no confusion that when you do something, it's for a specific purpose. And so we're recommending three things here today. One is to keep the two areas closed. Secondly, extend the season for 30 days in the Lower James River. And thirdly, to establish this workshop for further evaluation of oyster restoration efforts in Virginia. Jim has, again, a PowerPoint he can go through briefly.
Hold our questions until Jim finishes, and then we'll go to the public hearing. Dr. Wesson?
I just want to real quickly run through the slides that we had before, then I rearranged a little bit, took some out. But one question that came up at the last meeting that it's in your briefing, if you looked at it, there was some question on whether or not we were doing seed. So I tallied up for you in a chart, in a table, how much seed we've done since 93 when the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel was completed. And that's in there for you, and you can see it's a significant amount, over 550,000 bushels since 93 of seed that we've moved. And if you look at the same time at the oyster harvest for the same time period, we only caught 120-some thousand bushels of oysters. So moving seed did not translate into, you can look year to year, a year or so after the seed was planted and see if you can even see it in the harvest. And usually you cannot. And that's while we're always very, very careful on seed movements. But just wanted to reemphasize the fact that no matter what you're thinking about, to keep this picture in your mind on, you know, how low we are in our harvest annually. We've had 2 years of unusual, a little blip, but if you look at it in the bottom diagram, historically, it's still just a minor increase compared to what we did historically and the levels we'd like to get back to. 100,000 seems really good in the day in comparison to the, since 93, but it's not so good in comparison since the 50s. The areas that we're talking about are these two red areas. It's there. Mather, Rappahannock, and the James are two very different areas. You can't even think about one while you're thinking about the other because they have very different biological characteristics. This is the lower Rappahannock. The area that's been requested is to open from the Route 3 bridge to the line that's drawn from Steamer Rock to Steamer Point over to Sturgeon Bar. Remember that this area was restored starting in 1999 with a partnership with DEQ and the Coastal Resource Management Program, where we've been working on it pretty continuously with NOAA funds, Corps of Engineer funds, EPA funds, as long as private and state funds since that time period. But in the process, on the eastward side of the Route 3 bridge, it has remained closed. There's about 150 acres in there that we've restored. Where westward has been open since 2002, and there's about 350 acres in that area, in the harvesting area, that have been restored and are restored every year. And we keep them up, and they're open for harvest. So it's more than twice the amount that's open for harvest is closed. In that process, we hired watermen to do the work for a lot of the effort. So they were paid in the effort of doing the work, and partnership is still together and still very interested in the results from the project. But we are doing stock assessment on the areas, following both the areas with harvest and the areas without harvest. And the one key thing to remember in thinking about this area right now are at least two things. First is whether you're talking about areas of no harvest or harvest. If you look over at the axis on the left, you're talking about standing stocks of oysters that are teeny. When we talk about the James River, we're talking about areas that have hundreds of oysters per meter. The best we're into in the James, in the Rappahannock, in this area we're talking about opening, this is the area, the no harvest area. If you add the spat, the smaller, and market together, we don't even have 10 oysters per meter as an average. That's not nearly close enough to guarantee any sort of fertilization for oysters. And if you harvest from that area, it gets even lower. The second thing is the difference between the Rappahannock and the James River in spat set and just the normal way that oysters spawn in different areas. The James River has dependable spat sets, so we've had this season down there where we could afford to, say, even extend the season for another month. The reason we can extend the season there is because we know spat sets are dependable. For the Rappahannock, the spat sets are not dependable. You can see that even in good years, you're only talking about 25 spat per meter or so. But we've had 3 years in a row where we've just had one or two spat per meter, and that is just no way you can biologically suggest that you harvest areas where you don't have recruitment. And this is the overall trend in the standing stock throughout that area. And again, the total number of bushels that are out there are 25,000 bushels. Where when you see the same graph for the James River, you're talking about almost 1 million bushels. So now to switch down to talking about the James, the area they want to open is from the purple hatched area, which is our sanctuary area, up to the purple line that kind of is the lion's share of the historic seed rocks of Virginia. We know from them studies, very good studies, that the larvae for that area, as well as the area that we're harvesting in, which is down where the big yellow areas, come from this area that there are seed rocks where the densities are very high. They are natural reefs. that we have pictures of since the 1870s, that they're the only place we have left in the state that still has three-dimensional reefs that are natural as opposed to ones that we've created. They used to come to the surface. You can see that red line on the right where that long area came out of the water at low tide. Even in 1900, they came out. But I was trying to think of a way to describe to you. I dive in the bay, and I look at the Oyster Rocks, and so I have a visual image of what I'm trying to explain. It's hard to explain to someone that doesn't dive. But this, when you have a thick rock in the James River, this is what you see. It's broken bottom with clumps of oysters. And this is a picture from Seaside, which is very similar. It's a seed area also. Low, high spat sets, aggregates of oysters, and if you could take the water out of the James River and you look at these areas where we have a lot of oysters, these little clumps have 1,000 oysters per meter in them in a lot of cases. But if you would move a moving dredge across them, you would knock those clumps down, and there's no guarantee that you'll ever, when you're culling out, that you're going to put the oysters back on that little spot. With hand tongs, you catch the oysters up, you're sitting still, you drop them right back to where you got them up from. But when you talk about moving hand scrapes on these areas, there's no way that you can maintain the integrity of the way the oysters sit up and make their own little reefs like we see naturally. And again, to point out, this is the total standing stock of bushels in the area in the James River we're talking about, which is just many, many times more oysters per meter and total oysters than we're talking about in the Rappahannock, where we have very low standing stocks. We're doing restoration there, but they're entirely different systems. So those are the main items that I wanted to bring back up before we got into the public hearing. Any questions
for Jack or Jim?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, indeed. Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Wesson, the partnership that you described in the Rappahannock, can you tell us a little bit more about that? You said it involved DEQ, and this is the Oyster Heritage.
The Oyster Heritage Program was formed in 1999. We had been becoming a little bit successful in some of our restoration efforts and building three-dimensional reefs, and we pretty much have been working on state funds and small grants, and we wanted to see if we could extend this program into a bigger arena and get some press and get public interest in oyster restoration of oysters. And DEQ, being a much bigger agency than ours, partnered with us with their Coastal Resource Management Program and helped us with the visibility that we needed, along with helped us put a big partnership together where instead of just doing these reef projects and restoration projects with $200,000 to $300,000 a year, we were actually able to combine NOAA and our money and the Corps and EPA together and generate about $1.5 million for just this one project a year for it. We kept it going for 3 or 4 years at that level, and then we've maintained it at several $100,000 through NOAA money after that time. So it was a very large project that was really the first big partnership effort in the Bay to do oyster restoration. It's become the norm now, but it was the starting of it.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Dr. Wesson?
Yes.
Mr. Garrison?
Jim, when you feel like it, I live in the Rappahannock, so I'm more familiar with that than I have the James, but some of these bids that are done, we hear all kind of ideas about small oysters and need to be hand scraped maybe and turn them over or whatever. When do you feel like in your own mind that this could be done in certain, say, a rock or two along? Would you want to do it a rock or two at a time to find out what's actually happening there?
That's exactly what we're doing right now. We're following the oysters in the closed area below the bridge in comparison. We're taking 150 acres that are there, comparing to the 150 acres that are right adjacent to it. And we not only monitor, I'm showing you the standing stock, the spat smaller markets. But we also monitor boxes, which is mortality, and we monitor shell, how much shell is on the bottom. If the dredging, there's three things that can tell you if turning over the bottom and harvesting is doing good or bad. It's mortality. It's whether you see spat set as good in the harvested area versus non-harvested area. We're following that. But the third important thing that we're watching is we measure the amount of cult that's on the bottom or the shells. And right now, there's no difference in the shells on the harvested area and the non-harvested area, which would indicate to you, which is what most of the studies have always shown, that an orchard rock that's healthy in the right spot on a natural area will maintain its cleanliness. The shells will stay up without working. In fact, this area that we're harvesting in the James River right now hadn't been touched with any restoration or harvest for more than 20 years, and it repopulated itself because the shells are natural there. They stay up. Harvesting is not necessary on natural rocks to maintain their integrity. So that study is what we are so focused on in the mouth of the Rappahannock with right now.
Yep. So when people talk about working the beds, if you've got a natural three-dimensional oyster bed, it doesn't need to be worked.
No. It stays
clean. It doesn't silt over.
Yep.
Now, a lot of these private beds and other beds that are in low-lying areas that are flat,
They were never natural,
that they've been shelled. They have to be turned up and turned over.
Exactly. Okay.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
And, Dr. Weston, one of your arguments, I guess, in your initial evaluation was that the productivity of the rock in the James River is precisely linked to its three-dimensional structure.
Three-dimensional structure and its the Upper James River is like a seaside is very similar to it. It's in an area of extremely high sediment load. There, the orchards must maintain their cleanliness of themselves by their pumping. But if you take a grab, like we take a grab with a patent tong, you go through the shells into mud immediately in a single grab. They're sitting right on top of the mud. Now, there is a whole hill of shells underneath there in the three-dimensional structure, but it's covered all the time by the feces from the orchards as well as the sediment that's naturally in that high sediment load area. So if you would just go put shells there with no live orchards, they would just cover over sediment almost immediately. It's that three-dimensional structure and all those orchards standing up. They keep themselves clean. It's the orchards come back and reattach on them, and that's why we're very careful. With hand tonging, you know, you're taking up a small area, shells go right back on that spot, and there are enough orchards in the area because of, you never cut it that low with hand tonging. You never get the densities that far down that you maintain that integrity. You keep the orchard pumping, and you keep the orchards setting upright and enough to keep the beds clean.
So the hand tonging has allowed the reefs to exist in their existing structure, but your argument is that that hand scraping would compromise the structure and basically wipe it out. Thanks.
Thank you. Any more questions, Dr. Weston?
Oh, one other question. Now, as far as when you work a bar, are you talking about working it when right before you put seed down so it'll set, or do you work it all the time to keep the oysters clean?
Well, and that's one of the fallacies of working it in order to keep it up. If you truly want to do that effort for spat set and to keep orchards up, you wouldn't go out and do it until the middle of June to the end of June when spat set's going to occur. Working the bottom during our season has almost no impact at all because it's enough sediment comes down to cover that over. In the meantime, between the time we harvest in the winter and the summertime. So if you were truly interested in doing that as a effort, which we have done a lot of projects where we do something that's called bagless dredging, where we pay the waterman to take the bag off the dredge and just pull the teeth of their dredge right in June and July when spat set's occurring to see if that would improve spat set. All the studies that we've done in my tenure, and we've done a number of them, as well as the ones that have been done in Maryland as long as I've been here, have shown no difference between doing that and not doing it. One of the big problems is the oysters are so low. Spicet is so undependable on time that you can almost never time things perfect to be there the week before they set, because we just don't see the spicet that we saw historically. It's, you know, it's one of the facts of being at 1% of the population that you.
So the bar silts over within a week or so after you you work it.
Thank you.
Sure.
All right, we're now going into public hearing.
I'm not quite sure who's chair at the moment. Mr.
Garrison. Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Mr. Garrison, sir, is acting chair. I'm Roger Manson, Virginia Institute of Marine Science. And today I've prepared for you a presentation on the status of the beds in the James River. Normally I try and come up here, get to the point, and sit down. This argument of... we got the wrong one?
Not yet.
That's what happens when you have these DOS systems. This argument about whether or not we should put hand scrapes in the upper part of the James is one that I'm sufficiently passionate about that I'm going to give you a slightly longer presentation. The question is, what is the status of the oyster populations and their habitat? The answer is that it's stable but extraordinarily fragile. You have a very large number of oysters up there. Last time we were here, Jim called it a national treasure. It is a national treasure. And what I'm going to tell you about today is why I think it is stable, but why I think it's also very susceptible to damage, and that if you damage it, you will start a process of downhill slide that you will have an extraordinarily difficult time to reverse. So the issue is the balance between what I like to call recruitment, young animals coming in, and mortality, things dying. The shell base is an extraordinarily important part of that particular balance. I'm going to show you an awful lot of data here, almost 10 years' worth. But I really want to hammer home this point about the fragility of this system. So if we get a little lost in the technical details, I apologize. But this is worth dealing with. There's a
Dr.
whole bunch
Mann,
of reasons.
Can I interrupt you a bit? Now, you're dealing with the James River and the Rappahannock separate in this presentation. Is that right?
I'm going to talk about the James. I'm not going to talk about the Rappahannock.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about the James. And that section of the James, which is currently being debated as to whether or not it should be open to hand scrape. I can comment on the area downstream afterwards if you want, but I want to focus on the area upstream because that's where we have all of our data. We've been doing stock assessments out here since 1993, and in about 1995 I came before this august body because there was this question about how we actually did all this sampling. Was the data any good? I'm actually going to repeat a little bit of that presentation here because, with the exception of Mr. Pruitt, every face on this podium has changed since then. And it's very important to understand how we collect this data because on this data we build our decisions. This data is unique. There is not another oyster stock assessment program anywhere in the world that does this. And without being conceited, we have the best data set in the world to do this with, and we can do some things with it that nobody else can. And so it's important that you understand how we do this sampling, because when you look at it initially, it might look a little bit strange. It is based in very standard statistical sampling. We use something called stratified random surveys. I'll show you what they are. When we started this in 1993, we used a 19-reef system. We added four more the year after, and ever since then, we have done surveys on 23 different reef systems. The number of stations per reef, that's the number of pattern tong grabs that you use, is determined by something called the standard error of the mean. I'll explain that to you. And we sample with a hydraulic pattern tong. And it's really important to understand what the value of this is, because it tells you not only what's on the surface, it tells you what's underneath the surface. This is the only data set that exists that tells you what goes on deeper than this far down. There are over 4,000 data sampling points within this. Nobody else has got those. We have, so we can talk about that. I can give you the information on the number of oysters per square meter. From that, I can tell you how much biomass there is out there, how much actual mass of oysters, how many eggs are produced. The demographics. What is demographics? It is the size distribution of the animals, how many small ones, how many bigger ones, how many bigger ones, how many of the biggest ones. That's important because you use that demographic to determine the age of the oysters. In much the same way as if you were to look around this room and you could ask how many people are between 30 and 35, 35 and 40, you would develop a demographic. I'm going to show you how we develop demographics of oysters. It's very important because it tells you in what year things recruited and how long they lived before they died. And then I'm going to tell you why they died. And it is the patterns of recruitment, new ones coming in, the patterns of mortality, things dying, that tells us so about how long things stay there and why it is fragile. It becomes very, very important. I can also tell you from the boxes how old they were when they died. And that's important because it gives me a separate way of estimating mortality. I'll tell you about the shell that's there as well. There's a whole bunch of other things that we've collected. This is not meant to give you eye strain. This is how we do stratified random sampling. And I want to show you that it works because I've been challenged on this before. Individuals who've seen us in the field say, hey, you know, the oysters aren't here. They're over there. Your data can't be any good because you're not sampling in the right place. And at that point, the conversation stops. I'm going to show you in a very simple piece of math why this works. Okay? What you have here is an oyster reef with 100 units of area in it. There are 100 oysters on this. If they were evenly spread out, it would be very easy. I could go and sample one square here and multiply it by 100. If that were indeed the case, sampling would be easy. Oysters aren't like that. So if you take 100 oysters in 100 squares and you aggregate them, you get things like this, where most squares are zeros, some are twos, some are fours, some are fives, some are sixes. And what you end up with is something that looks like the distribution of these animals on the bottom. This gentleman just gave me a good pointer. I hope I can work out how to use it. So what you end up with is aggregations. How do you sample this? I know that the answer is that there's 100 oysters on there. I know that there's 100 squares. What I don't know is what the distribution is, and yet I'm going to tell you that I can work out the answer. The way I do this is by random sampling. I've got 100 squares, and so I give them all a number, 1 through 100. Then I go to a random number table. Those of you who did math in high school probably remember picking through these in books. Now you can get them on computers. What a random number table will do is give you a random number of orders from 0 to 100, but it will tell them in random order. So I went through this, and I just told the computer to give me a list of random numbers. They turned out in this particular instance to be 92, 55, 1, 23, and these tell me the order in which I go out and sample my squares. Okay? So I start down here, then I go up here, then I go to this one, then I go to this one, and I continue to follow these. And you're sitting there and you're thinking, well, is it a zero? Is it a zero? Is it a zero? If he keeps doing this, he's going to run out to about 50 squares before he actually gets anything. He's going to get a completely junk number. Well, let me show you what happens when you do this lots of times. This is how you do it. This is the first one I sample, the second one, the third one, the fourth one, the fifth one, and so on. And this is the number that comes out in the random order. So in this one, it tells me to go to square 73, square 54, square 61, square 90, square 89. In this one, and I do this. And you might ask yourself, how did I get this distribution to start with? I didn't fudge it. I actually gave this to my youngest son, and I said, there's 100 marks on this, and your math problem tonight is to move them around so that there's still 100 left. And that's what he came up with. The only boundary I put on this was he couldn't put all the 100 in the same square. I thought that was pretty reasonable. So anyway, you do this, and what happens is that the first one you go to, square 73's got none in. Square 54's got two in. Square 61's got zero in. And so you keep doing this. And you do it many times. And what you'd like to do as you go along is keep a running average. Because that's what you do when you do this sort of sampling. You keep sampling until you get a decent average. So choose another one. This one. The first one I sampled had seven in it. The second one had zero. So the average of those two is 3.5. The next one was zero. The average of that was 2.3. The average was... And you keep going. You know, this gets a whole lot easier if you plot it and look like this. The blue line is the number that are in each successive square. So this one, there's nothing in the first square, there's two in the second square, there's nothing in the third square, there's nothing in the fourth, there's two in the fifth, and so you keep going. The purple line that goes along is the running average. And you can do this as many times as you like. The real interesting thing about that running average is if you ever notice this is 1, how quickly that runs back towards 1. And if you do this 20 times, which I think is how many times I do it down here, by the time you get out to about 8 samples, in all but 2 stations, the answer is always between 1.5 and 1/2. I knew nothing about the distribution of these to start with. And yet if you do this simple piece of math, guaranteed, time after time after time, it will give you the answer. So when we do stratified random sampling, it turns out that there is a way of estimating the number that are out there, providing you know the boundary, you can actually estimate what's out there. And if anybody wants to try the math, it's very, very simple. What comes out of doing this for 10 years I'm going to talk about? There are 3 categories of reefs that really come out when you start to do this with consistency over the period I'm going to talk about. There are 3 effective high-density reefs, those at Orsted, those at Moon Rock, and those at V-Rock, consistently between 200 and 500 oysters per square meter. There are 3 rocks, Pointy Shoal, Cross Rock, Triangle Rock, that are between 90 and 200, and all the rest come out between 1 and 100. This is consistent, absolutely dead solid statistically over an 11-year period. The thing that's frightening about this from a management point of view is you've got very high densities here. And when you work that out in terms of the numbers of the population or whatever, you've got about 30% of the population in 2.5% of the area. If you go up to the next bit, you end up with another 15% in about another 3.5%. Now, if you add these two together, you've got a little over 7%, a little around 7% of the area with nearly 50% of the oysters in it. At this point in time, these are only subject to harvest for the hand tong. I'm going to tell you why these are absolutely seminal to the maintenance of this population out here. And if you disturb these, the consequences of disturbing and removing them is that the recruitment patterns that you will see will go down. You are looking at a very small area that is going to be extraordinarily enticing to harvest. You can harvest this with a hand tong. I am not at all objectionable to harvesting things with hand tongs. This is not about setting a limit. This is about how you harvest them. There are a lot of oysters out there, you can go harvest them. What you cannot do is destroy the bottom underneath. You absolutely cannot do that. It turns out that these are numbers. I'm now going to turn them into ages. We're doing this all for the EIS process, but we're going to show you a little bit about it today. When you look at where these reefs are, there's a few of them here. There's one down here, but basically they're in this region here. Where they are is important because this area up here is highly subject to spring freshets. This area down here is highly subject to high salinity during the summer that actually advances the impact of disease. These ones sit in the middle here. They are essentially somewhat buffered in both directions, although I will show you that they suffer from mortalities as well. And partially because they sit here, and partially because of the gyre-like circulation, they self-recruit. So that's where we are when we look at them geographically. You'll note that at this point, the line with respect to hand scrapes is down here. If it's moved, practically all of this area becomes susceptible. Just, we'll talk a little bit about long-term trends in, I use the term biomass, Jim uses the term bushels. You know what, we're actually talking about the same thing. There's a couple ups and downs in this graph that I want to show you that are very important. There's a lot of stuff on this graph, so bear with me. This is the total of all the oysters in our stock assessment, the blue. Then what you're going to see is these red areas here. These are those 3 high-density reefs. These ones here are the medium-density reefs, and these are the low-density reefs. Now remember that these, the red and the yellowy ones here, these ones that are actually in the bottom here, these constitute 7% of the area, nearly half of all the oysters that are out there. Look at the trend over time, though. What you'll see here is you'll see these occasional significant mortality events. I'm going to come back to them. There was a big one, effectively, in 2002. This had been stable 1, 2, 3 years, and then it went down. When mortality occurs, it's very important. Remember that the maintenance over the long term of this is a balance between recruitment, the young ones coming in, mortality, the big ones going out. If you get those things out of sync and you get mortality, 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 no recruit, you've got yourself a dickens of a problem. This system survives because those are in very fine balance. I told you that we could go and look at ages. How do we get ages out of oysters? You don't ask them. It turns out that oyster hinges have lines in them, much like trees do, and you can count them like that. You can also estimate age by actually monitoring the growth of individual animals, which we did laboriously to produce a growth curve. What that allows you to do is to take something like this that looks like a complete mess. This is the size frequency in 1 year, the next year, the next year, and you go, boy, there's a lot of information, and convert it into something that's called an age frequency. So if you follow this particular line, 1998, this tells you how many per square meter there were. This is actually horse head. How many there were that were spat, 1 year old, 2 year olds, 3 year olds, 4 year olds, all the way through. And what you can see is that it's generally fairly stable, and there, every now and again, you'll get a year when you get a very large number of spats. So this number goes up. The 0 year class is the spat. This is the spat that occurred in 2002. In 2002, this became the 1 year olds in 2003. From here to here tells you how many die. So if you plot this sort of thing, you can actually say when the recruitments occur, and you can actually follow a year class through to see whether they all die in the first year, the second year, the third year, or if they don't die at all. We can actually do this. Now, I'm going to go back to how these things are spatially arranged, because it's very important. Does the demographic, that 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 year, suggest that, in fact, this reef just maintains itself, or does this reef supply this reef? Does this reef supply this reef? Is this all one mix? Can you start cutting it up? Because one of the things that you can argue about when you look at an area this big is, well, let's just do that reef. Let's just do that reef. It turns out that I believe this is a very tightly coupled system. The whole thing works together. So when you manage it as a unit. You don't draw any more lines across it. There's a lot of information on this one. Bear with me, because it's very important. 1998, 99, 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003. These are the high reefs, the medium reefs, the low reefs. And what I've done is I've taken the number of spat, 1 year olds, 2 year olds, 3 year olds, 4 year olds, and I've plotted them as a percentage of the total. So if you add up these numbers, they add up to 100. The important point when you look at this is to ask, are there any fundamental differences between real high density reefs, medium density reefs, and low density reefs all the time? And one of the things that's sort of striking about this is you actually see that these reefs respond in much the same way in time. This pattern is fairly consistent with this one. This one's a bit high, but otherwise it's consistent. This one is consistent with this one, is consistent with this one. In any one particular year, when there's a good recruitment, it tends to recruit throughout the system. When there's a big mortality, it tends to happen more or less throughout the system. So what you're looking at is that the system functions as a whole. Everything here interacts with everything else. They are not spatially separate. The way in which this is looked at typically with finfish, and I'm sure Dr. Jones is sick of looking at these things, is called something called stock recruitment curves. Stock recruitment curves are things that you try to optimize in fishery rebuilding plans. This is precisely how the Fisheries Management Council does things. They look at the size of a stock and they say, how many recruits, how many young can we expect from animals of this size? If it's not enough, then we're going to limit the catch. Because if we can make the parent size bigger, the number of offspring gets bigger. Eventually, you get to the point where you saturate the system and it doesn't get any bigger. I can assure you that's not the case here. But if you try plotting stock recruitment curves for all these animals, what you find is that you find these oddball points. These oddball points are all in 1 year. Perhaps the easiest way of looking at it is like this. What's the replacement ratio? A replacement ratio is the number of spat that set every year as a ratio to the number of adults that are out there every year. Now, if you only expect to live 1 year, if your population is going to be stable, you better have a replacement ratio of 1. Every animal is replaced every year. Otherwise, the population goes down. If you live to be 2 years old, you get 2 shots at this, so if you have a replacement ratio of 1/2, it will keep you stable. 3 years, it's 1/3. 4 years, it's quarter, and so on and so on and so on. undisturbed oysters, not challenged by disease, after 50 million years of evolution, typically you expect oysters to live anywhere between 10 and 30 years. They don't anymore. Over 50 million years worth of evolution, if you live to be 10 years old, on average, you need a replacement ratio of 0.1 to be stable. What you see when you look at replacement ratios are the product of millions of years of evolution. What you see here in most instances through 98 all the way through 2003, many of these numbers are well below 1. Many of them are below a half. What that tells you is that at that point in time, this system is just about managing to keep up with itself. And in some instances, it's actually losing ground slightly. On the other hand, every now and again, you get a really good recruitment. A wrap-up spat set, big year class. This is not at all unusual in fisheries, that you'll see a big recruitment one year and it will maintain a fishery through a number of years. The interesting thing is that over this time, that occurred in 2002. I've already told you that we had a big mortality event in 2002, so how did this work? It turns out that what you do is you get a good recruitment early in the year of the young, and then all the old ones die later in the year. What that tells you, at least at the first instance, is you have to be very careful because conditions that foster recruitment may also be conditions that foster mortality of the older animals. And I'll show you that that is indeed the case. The summary so far, we do have what we call stable sources and sinks. There are places that produce larvae, and they recruit them to somewhere else. The system is very fragile because the replacement ratio is typically much less than one. The use of stock recruit curves has been used elsewhere. We should think about using them here. We have these long-term quantitative things that tell you that this is a single system. You can't deal with it. The scales in relevance are not just those of a single estuary. Here, though, we've shown that it is. All right, I've talked to you about where the oysters go. The real issues that I haven't talked about are disease and shell. What I've tried to do so far is to show you how the population goes up and down, and we can demonstrate that. What drives it going up and down? What you need to do is estimate mortality.
Yeah. Roger, can I just ask you a question? You haven't discussed the potential for depensatory mortality or allele effects. Are you going to get to that?
I'm not going to do it in here because it'll take all day. But if you want to, I can, yes.
Could you explain that?
There are some effects that relate to the densities of the animals. At very high densities, do you get density effects that actually encourage recruitment or encourage mortality. And these are called compensatory, and they're called alley effects. You do see some of them here. But for the sake of where we're going today, I'm not going to go there because it will take us too long. You need to be able to estimate mortality, the rates at which things die. There are two ways that you can do that. If I know how many oysters are alive this year, in a year class, and I know how many of them were here last year, I know how many died. This is exactly the way in which your life insurance companies estimate your premium. It's no different. And you can do that by estimating the live in any one year and the live in the year before it. Bit of math, you can estimate mortality. You can also estimate it from the number of boxes. If you know how many were alive at one point, and then you know how many survive and how many boxes are there, you can do it from box ratios. There are various ways of doing it. If you plot it all, it works. If you want to have an explanation of the map, I can do that. The important point is that over time, I can tell you how fast the 2-year-olds, the 3-year-olds, and the 4-year-olds, and in some instances, the 5-year-olds die. I've told you something about the recruitment bit from the replacement ratio. I'm now going to tell you something about the dying bit. There's a lot of stuff in here, and really all I want you to see is that high-density, medium-density, low-density reefs, they tend to be higher on the low-density reefs, and the things that you really worry about are these really high values here. In those particular years, you're losing 80 to 90% of a single year class, and that happens to be 2002, which is the year when we got great recruitment. What drives recruitment? What drives mortality? It turns out it has a lot to do with river flow, and river flow has a lot to do with disease. There are three lines on this graph, believe it or not. There are actually two lines here that sit almost on top of one another, and I guarantee you this was not fudged. One of them is the salinity at Rex Shoal, which is calculated from the daily river flow that comes from the U.S. Geological Survey data. The other one is the prevalence of Pekinsis disease. Pekinsis disease kills oysters. It turns out, as you can see, these two lines go absolutely up and down in unison. When you get low river flow, you get high salinity. When you get high salinity, you get high disease, you get high mortality. When you get high salinity, you also get the things to spawn before they die, and you get good recruitment. You can do this for the Rex Shoal data set. You can do it for the Pointy Shoal data set. The answers come out the same. So you have a system here that's extraordinarily driven by the river flow. And if you plot these disease numbers against the salinity numbers, you get these incredible lines which statisticians salivate about. The important point there, though, is you cannot control river flow. You can't control salinity. And so what you have on an annual basis is this lottery of how much water is going to come down the river. And that is going to determine what sort of patterns you're going to see. All right, does this disease thing actually explain a large amount of the mortality? It, in fact, it does. These are the mortality numbers for the high and the medium reefs over a series of years. This year had a low disease incidence going in, and it went up, and these are the lines of mortality. This had a slightly higher disease incidence going in, and you get higher mortality. When the disease incidence came down, the mortality came down. And again, this data is data that's completely independently derived. I did the red stuff. The rest of it comes from the Oyster Disease Program at the VIMS that I have nothing to do with. The only thing it goes way off kilter is up here, where suddenly you get abnormally high mortalities. And you know what that is? This is dermo plus MSX. Here what happens is the second disease came in and clobbered you on top of the first disease. The really important point is disease has a tremendous amount to do with what you see out there in terms of mortality, and disease is controlled by salinity. Salinity you cannot manage. You can do it for the Rex Shoal data set, and it does exactly the same thing. So on sitting on top of all this substrate, what you have is a very fragile system whose long-term well-being is in this balance between diseases at high salinity, recruitment at high salinity, low recruitment at low salinity, low diseases, survival at low salinity. It doesn't matter which way you go in this, you can't win. And you're sitting literally in the middle. All of this sits on top of the shell base. And this is really why we're here. The shell base is very important, as Jim said. These are some numbers in terms of liters per square meter. I'm sorry this is all metric, but I will translate it for you. These are the high-density reefs, the medium-density reefs, the low-density reefs. This number here is 25 liters per square meter. That is 1 inch thick of shell. As Jim said, when you go through the shell here, there is not a lot of shell underneath it. This is not like some of the other reefs in the bay. This is a veneer. This is a tile floor. If you start breaking this, it will fall apart. This is 500 oysters per square meter. This is 300 oysters per square meter. This is about 20 to 25 per square meter. Look at the difference that you have, and look at the very fragile possibility that you have of reducing this to this, simply by partially burying it or breaking it. These are extraordinarily thin layers. If you had a shell base that was this thick out there, maybe I wouldn't get so uptight about this. But this is a very thin shell base. If you put a hand scrape in that, you will break it. You absolutely will break it. Why will you break it? The first practical use of a cell phone. High school physics. Do any of you remember something called the coefficient of limiting friction? Over my 25 years in this business, I've worked with everything from oyster dredges to rocket dredges to deep sea research dredges, and I've spent the last 10 years of my career partially spending my time calibrating hydraulic dredges for the National Marine Fisheries Service and the ocean cohog and the surf clam industry, and those calibrations I use for the national stock assessments. I know a little bit about how dredges work. When you deal with something that you put on the bottom that has teeth on it, and you pull it, it does not do this. The
coefficient of limiting friction tells you that the energy that you have to put into a body to start it moving is higher than the amount of energy that you have to put into it to keep it moving. If all dredges were perfect sleds, the difference between those two functions would be very small. Dredges are designed not to be perfect sleds. They are designed to dig. The way in which you load them to put that energy in is essentially through the elasticity of the tow rope. You can actually do this if you tow a hand crane. You can actually see it if you tow a 120-inch knife hydraulic dredge behind a 150-foot ocean-going vessel that's looking for quahogs. They use ropes that are this big, and if you stand on the king post and you hold it, you can feel the thing going backwards and forwards. That's the modulus of elasticity of the rope, and it is the energy being transferred into the digging process. If you put digging into this, you will break it. This is a matter of high school physics. It's not a matter of opinion. This is a matter of 4,000 data points that are unparalleled anywhere in the world. This is not a matter of opinion. If you put hand scrapes in there, you will break this. I am not at all objectionable to letting watermen fish in here with hand tongs. I think this is fine. What I am objectionable to is putting a hand scrape in here. And I don't think anybody would argue with the data. So the conclusions. The population may appear to be stable, but it's in fact in a fragile equilibrium between recruitment and mortality. A lot of it exists in a very small amount of the area, which if you open this, it will become subject to hand scrapes. Salinity is a driving but uncontrollable function. You can't do anything about that. In high salinity years, new oysters set. Mortality of older oysters occurs. In low salinity, it's the opposite. There are no obvious long-term scenarios in which I can get the recruitment to go up and up and up here without getting the mortality to go up and up. So it lives in balance. The diseases can be related to dermo and MSX. In most years, you have a replacement ratio that's fairly adequate. On those years when you do get a replacement ratio that is greater than one, it occurs relatively infrequently. And it is those year classes that are maintaining large recruitments in fisheries. It is the 2002 year set at the moment that's maintained the great harvest that we've had over the last couple of years. These recruitment and mortality patterns are consistent across all of the reefs, and the shell oyster resource underneath that is absolutely central to keeping this all together. As I said, this is like dragging on a fine tile floor. If you break it, it will get worse. This is in fine equilibrium at the moment. You don't want to mess with it. Thank you. Questions?
Any question, Dr. Weston?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Mann. And it's been a long time since I had high school physics. All right, we'll now open the public hearing. You want to be first?
Yes, sir.
All right, come right on up. Ask you to state your name and who you represent if you're speaking for yourself, and take your hat off when you address the commission.
Okay, yes, sir.
Thank you.
My name is William Frank Nelson, and it says here on my notes that I'm supposed to thank you, Mr. Pruitt, and I'd like to take that opportunity to do that. And I'd also like to thank all the watermen that showed up here today. I'm here representing the Rappahannock River. I've been working on the water. I'm a waterman, third generation, been on the water for 25 years. Had the opportunity to work up and down the coast with scallop dredges. I have a lot of experience with dredges, and I don't agree with some of the things that Dr. Mann has to say here. All my dredge with me so that everybody can get a good look at this instrument of destruction that for 7 years thereabouts we've been dragging on the western side of the Rappahannock. Now, according to Mr. Weston's own graphs here, I'll let you look at, clearly states that the watermen take the market oysters and return the undersized or small oysters back to the bottom to be caught when they grow to market size. Now, if you look at those graphs, he's had the eastern side of the Rappahannock closed. The only thing he opens it up for is for his experiments to take this brood stock and move it around to different places for it to just go ahead and die. Now, according to his own words, as he addressed...
Let me correct you on something.
Yes, sir.
Any open enclosures are done by the commission.
Yes, sir.
He may, Mr. Weston may recommend, but this commission takes the action. That's why you're here today.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Can I just add a hand by passing these handouts out?
Sure. Pass them out. Yeah.
It's good.
Thank you. Mr. Commissioner.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Garrison.
How much does this the dredge weigh?
This dredge here weighs approximately 50 pounds.
Thank you.
With no additions to it. Now, some people like to put additions on it. They like to put a couple window weights over here and a few different weights. I use mine just like it is. I use my line adjustment to make it dig more or less, depending on whether it's a muddy bottom, or we're working on an edge, or we're working on a lump, or we're working on top of the rock, which, as Dr. Mann says, is very fragile in a lot of places. But my conclusion is that, and of course this is my opinion, Mr. Pruitt, and I don't want you to think that anybody else has anything to do with this. We go to certain areas out there, like the drumming grounds, and when the season starts off, we start dragging these dredges around, and we can't even get 5 bushels. Because we're digging through the shells that have been carpeted on top of these living oyster rocks. Once we get through those shells, we'll start seeing spat. We'll start seeing strike. We see the small oysters as you go down through the layers of it. Some of those places, now I haven't been down to the bottom to look, but I do know that there's 25 boats that have worked in the Rappahannock, and Jim Weston can attest to that, in the last 3 to 6 years. And there's less than 25 boats there now. If we all get in a group in one area on this rock and we'll start working in small circles with this dredge, we can progressively go down through the layers of oysters. And you'll start out, you'll see all different shapes and sizes of oysters down through these layers because they're living down inside of this rock. And you have to get down in there with this dredge to get to them. The instrument that he uses to sample this bottom, I feel, is inferior. And he said it himself when he didn't allow us to use it anymore. Now, we were able to use a patent tong back in the day. Mr. Weston said that it was bad for the bottom, and that's fine. I feel that if he was going to take his samples out there, that he should have taken, you know, the same instrument that we use to get his sampling. Do you agree with that, Mr. Pruitt?
You're stuck here.
I'm sorry about the hat. This hat is very important to me, though. I mean, you know, it says Rappahannock oysters established in 1899.
Nice hat.
That brings up another. I would like to pass out another piece of paperwork, if I may.
Okay, now this piece of paperwork here, it states, like Doug Jenkins so eloquently stated before when we were here last meeting, that
it has always been a put-and-take fishery. Now, a put-and-take fishery, as you can see on this paperwork, goes back as far as right there. Now, these are Maryland records, not Virginia records. Virginia records are a staple of Maryland records. They go all the way from 1914 up to 1998 on the Maryland record of oysters. And the VMRC has always relied on a bagless dredge or harvesting for productivity of the oyster. And it has worked through the years. Not allowing an opening. And I don't agree with them saying that the three-dimensional reef. We don't go on the three-dimensional reef. We don't want to go on the three-dimensional reef. The reefs that are out there are very essential for convective larval swirl to replenish the rocks. But they say that, these gentlemen say that the shell does not have to be cleaned. Well, there's something else going out there on out there as well. It's called the vast sponge. And it's detrimental proportions. This bass sponge is an organism that grows within the oyster reef. It's a little round organism, feeds on the same things that the oysters feed on. Now, on the eastern side of that bridge, I had a permit signed by you to go out with Mr. Jensen to sample that reef around, you know, around his reef. And what I found was there was some oysters there, but a very, very heavy concentration of this bass sponge and sediment. And the oysters are laying down in the layers of that stuff. They could suffocate, and they will die. According to Mr. Weston's paper that I've passed there to you for the Congress when they tried to make the oyster an endangered species, he said in there that the larger oysters are prone to die within 2 to 4 years. I may be wrong on that. I have studied it and looked at it, but he said they're prone to die within 2 to 4 years. I don't understand why, if they're prone to die within 2 to 4 years, that you don't open a place up at least every 2 to 4 years to harvest some of these oysters so that they can be used for the economy instead of dying on the bottom for nothing, and have a bunch of watermen with this detrimental piece of equipment just dragging this around in a western area on 2 or 3 chosen rocks to grind those to pieces while they can go on the other side of the bridge and in 3 hours get their limit and go on home instead of recycling little oysters over and over again back onto the same rock. You have to bear with me. I'm not real good at speeches. I was here in 96. We were going to close the James River down, and I did a speech then, and luckily they kept it open and we worked it. I've got my paperwork all misconstrued here, and I'm going to get it together. Like I said about Doug Jenkins, it was tragic that Mr. Wesson and others have concentrated on natural restoration and accrual rather than applying more of the grant money towards planting seed and moving seed around into different areas. The lower Rappahannock, with the innovative artificial reefs providing a convective larval set, is a good brood stock. I mean, it's something that sends this larval out, and it's something that the watermen can never touch. These reefs are protected, and especially the ones of Mr. Jensen's, where they are way up off the bottom and they have concrete structure around them. Last time we were here, it was a gentleman up here talking about Mr. Jensen's reefs, and he said, I believe, that there was 700 to 800 oysters per square meter. Now, these are oysters that we can never touch. Now, one of those reefs is on the eastern side, and one is on the western side, on two opposite sides of the river. That larvae is running, I mean, spinning around and populating these rocks. If we were detrimental to this fishery, you would see no more small oysters over there. I mean, it's very simple to look at that graph that Mr. Wesson made up, and it tells you that the watermen are returning the small oysters. And according to his report to Congress, the small oysters in the first 2 year classes are the ones that are doing the breeding and populating those rocks, not the broodstock anymore, not the big ones. The small ones are most important, and those are the ones that we're putting back. The fact remains, you know, that the bigger oysters are particularly not disease resistant, and they're doomed to die by the next season. It's one thing to allow mature trees to rot to benefit woodpeckers, but it's a whole other thing to put a whole sawmill ethic at rest to save, you know. Thankfully, changes in forestry practices are miles ahead of practical marine science. Our being sore at the failures to protect our industry is nothing compared to us being unemployed. And we're all sorry and sorrowful that the situation has come to this. I mean, we're over here, we're looking at computer things that we can't even understand. We try to understand them. We try to abide by the laws. All we really want to do is go out there and work. And I feel that by looking at that chart, you can see that our work is not harming the oyster population. Disease, freshwater, a lot of other factors that historically have polluted the bay are more of a threat to the oyster than the watermen. There was, 25 years ago, 2,500 licenses sold for oystering. This year here, we're up to 2006. 400 licenses were sold. That's less than a tenth of what was there. So not only is the oyster in decline, but the oyster and the waterman is in decline. And we realize that. We're not trying to catch the last oyster. We're not trying to disturb Mr. Wesson's reefs. But we are trying to sustain our work ethic. And part of that is harvesting those oysters before they die, getting some of that sediment off the bottom, getting this vast sponge spread out so it's off of them and gives them a chance to breathe. I don't know what else I can say, but I'd like to say in closing, of course, you said that you make any recommendations, and I realize that. But I would like to ask you that to close the Rappahannock as scheduled, and I would like to see the lower Rappahannock open for a period of not less than 1 month, 15 bushels per boat limit. And I mean, extend the season into James River, start moving some seed. It's only fitting and right. And like I said, we went from 2,500 oyster licenses to 400 licenses.
All right,
so there
thank
is
you very
a
much.
Decline there as well.
Who's next?
Thank you.
Anyone else? Lionel, come on up, and then this gentleman over here.
Thank you, Mr. Pruitt.
Thank you, sir. You going to leave your dredge here for evidence?
Yeah. Well, if they don't open anything up, I can leave it here.
You won that one.
Mr. Pruitt, members of the committee, my name is Lionel Jenkins. I'm here representing the Waterman Association, myself mostly. I've listened to the people, what they said, and I'm sure you guys have heard it lots of times. Now, the point that the doctor made about he didn't mind people shabatonging in the Upper James River, but the dredge was going to do some damage. Probably in all types of work you do, you're going to do some damage with any type of gear you do. But it's strange to me that all the people that's got private ground, that's the only way they harvest their oysters is with the dredge. And I've yet to see one private owner come up and say that the dredge did any harm to his bottom, one way or the other. They take their oysters up with the dredge whenever they get time to do it. You know, so it seems to work for those guys. It's been working in the lower James River for the past 2 years. And we have gone over this bottom time and time and time again. I work this area today. I'll move over here. Someone else will come, go right there where I left yesterday, and they'll work all day long. And it's been a cycle all around. And the oysters are getting scarce there. And we need other areas. In my personal opinion, if the whole area had been open in the beginning, like we had a meeting before the season started, and it was put to the committee that Tangier would be open, the Rappahannock would be open, the York River would be open, and the James River would be open, and the people from different areas would work in the areas where they were closest to. They wouldn't have to travel a long distance to go to work. Neither would they be overpopulate the river, and there would be substantial amount of oysters there to keep working until the time was out, until the spring came, and they would go on to other things such as crabbing and fishing and stuff like that. That was what we recommended to the committee, but that wasn't what was voted on here. It was voted that all these Tangier would be open later, and the Rappahannock hasn't got open yet, the lower part, and neither has the upper James River. But getting back to some of the things that the doctor said, I'm sure he put a lot of time and effort in what he did here, and I commend him for it. But, you know, he might be able to get a good price for that if he could sell it to the bingo players. Because I don't think that's going to work as far as the average person is concerned. Because the best way I can describe this to you is there was a man, a professor, that got a grant, and he hired him a chauffeur, and he was going to universities all around the country and making this speech, the same speech at every university. And about 8 months into the program, the chauffeur said to him one morning, "I can make the same speech that you're making and just as good as you can." So he said, "You can't do it." He said, "I know, I have memorized the speech and I can make it just as good as you can." So the professor said, "All right. Nobody knows me at this college. They don't know you. We'll change clothes. And you do the speech, and I'll be the chauffeur. And we'll see how big a fool you're going to make of yourself." So he got up and he made the speech, and he had a standing ovation. Well, he made a little mistake. He got through about 10 minutes too soon. And the dean of the college got up and said, "I wonder if there's anybody in the audience would like to ask the professor a question." So he opened the door for it, and this fellow back about midway, he stood up, you know, two armfuls of books, and he said, "Sir, suppose a dinosaur died 50 million years ago, and layer upon layer of earth built up on that dinosaur, until right now, some wildcat oil driller drilled down through that dinosaur. My question to you is, what would be the pH in soil as it passed through the carcass of the dinosaur?" All right, you listen to this, is when it gets hairy. The chauffeur stood there and he was stunned for a minute or two. And then he said, "I'm going to tell you something. In all the days of my teaching, I've never heard a question as stupid as this question. In fact, it's so stupid and so easy to answer. My chauffeur's on the back row. I'll have him stand up and give you the answer." Now, the moral of this thing is there's too many professors in chauffeur suits. You see? There's too many people got the answers. Now, the doctor said, he told us all about why there weren't no oysters there. I would like to know why he can't tell us why they're not there. He said they die and they do die. But my point is today, we need more ground to open up to work, not to cast a snare on anybody, but we need more ground to work, and we need it now. If you people have listened to staff for 10 years and you've gone along with them, so why not go the way of the waterman just one time and see if it breaks the back of the camel? If it don't work for 1 month, you can bring it back and change it again. It's nothing chiseling in stone.
All right.
Thank you. That's all I
got. Thank you, Lionel. Who's next? That's right. Come on. Anyone after this gentleman? All right.
My name is Julian Cox, citizen of Pocosin and orchard gardener. The most valuable lesson I've learned gardening oysters is plant oysters, get shell. Plant shell, get oysters, and lots more. This is why there are more oysters living on the closed public reefs and why we are here today. The water purification capacity of oysters growing on protected and restored natural reefs combined with a growing community of oyster gardeners and a growing farm-based oyster industry are the best way to mitigate pollution caused by our activities living in the Bay watershed. More oysters living throughout the Bay tributaries will reduce the impact of pollution benefiting most citizens and the Virginia economy. For these reasons, and for now, I support the VMRC staff recommendation. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, sir. Paula, and then the gentleman over here next.
Good afternoon. My name is Paula Jasinski. I'm with NOAA's Chesapeake Bay office. I was just urged to come up with either a show and tell or a joke really quickly, and I have neither. NOAA spends more on-the-ground oyster restoration in the bay than any other federal agency. Our primary goal is a lofty one. It's to reverse the decline of the native oyster in the Chesapeake Bay through working with partners in states such as Virginia. We'd much prefer to work with watermen in this goal, but unfortunately, on these proposals at hand, we strongly support your staff's recommendations. I will echo what I frequently hear at these meetings, is that I grew up in the Northern Neck. I care deeply about the Chesapeake Bay. It's not any different depending on who you work for in this case. I do understand and we empathize strongly with the watermen's plight at this time, which is why NOAA works very closely with your state to ensure that our funds have been spent on a split between harvest and sanctuary sites. In the past 3 years alone, we've spent over $5 million in the state of Virginia on oyster restoration activities. In fact, when Virginia had little or no funds for a repletion program, NOAA Chesapeake Bay office stepped in and supported that program. Of more than 500 acres we've restored in the state, within the last 3 years, more than 400 of those were placed in harvest areas. Only 84 of those were in sanctuaries. The remaining acreage was on seed bars. The great majority of our efforts, as you already heard, have already been placed in waters to directly assist and benefit the watermen in this state. There was and is strong scientific rationale for setting aside these areas from harvest pressures in the lower Chesapeake Bay. The only way that we're going to get a disease-resistant strain within Chesapeake Bay of a native oyster is to allow some of them to continually battle against disease and harvest pressures. This is not going to happen in the next 3 years. It won't happen maybe in the next 10 years. It's going to continue our state's and the federal government's commitment to allowing some native oysters to avoid harvest pressures. We respect the 2002 compromise agreement between the Commonwealth and industry to open areas of the Rappahannock River upstream from the Route 3 bridge while we're maintaining the regions downstream from the bridge as a sanctuary for broodstock, where much of our funding has been spent on those sanctuary regions. The request at hand would open about half of that area below the bridge because it has accumulated broodstock, effectively negating its intended purpose. After millions of dollars in federal money spent here by NOAA and the oyster restoration activities, we feel that harvesting these areas provides a very trivial return on our investment and that a much larger return would be gained by protecting these areas. This would also be cause for NOAA to seriously reconsider future expenditures in oyster-related activities in the state. The fact that these once barren areas now actually contain oysters when others don't shows us that they are actually functioning in some capacity. It's an important component of your state's actual oyster management efforts, and we urge you to continue that. I also want to comment on the James River request. NOAA encourages the Commission to continue a restriction on the gear type in these James River seed beds. As you've already heard, the upper James River is home to some of the only remaining natural oyster beds in the bay. This area is currently open only to hand tonguing, and we understand this is the least damaging gear to these critically important reef structures. Opening these areas to dredging or hand scraping, as it's also known, would destroy these features in a very short time frame. They've existed for hundreds of years, and they continue to support healthy oyster populations. These intact oyster reef habitats would quickly be exhausted and permanently impacted if dredging were allowed. As you consider making changes to the oyster fishery and the regulations, I encourage you to keep in mind NOAA's strong partnership, record of partnership with your agency, both our financial support ecologically and for economic objectives for the oyster industry in Virginia. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Hello, my name is Brian Locke. I'm a resident of Pocosin. I'm more of a concerned citizen. I'm not a scientist or a waterman, just someone that reads the paper and watches the news and just have an opinion. I'd just like to say that I respectfully submit my request that you vote against allowing high-capacity hand-scraped dredges in the few remaining natural oyster reefs. I feel it's counterproductive to destroy these reefs while at the same time the Army Corps of Engineers and other groups are trying to rebuild reefs. I feel that the money would be better spent educating watermen and other individuals in the methods of aquaculture. There's quite a few publications that have explained how Europe has been a leader in aquaculture, and from what I understand, France produces approximately 30% of the world's oysters through aquaculture and approximately 100% of Europe's oysters through aquaculture. I just feel like money and time could be spent better by maybe turning towards aquaculture instead of dumping shells in the bay and dumping seeds in the bay, and maybe they can naturally reproduce if they're not disturbed for a while. That's just my opinion. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. All right, we got Roy and then this gentleman and then Doug. And what I'd ask you at this point is, with the issue before us is whether they open the James River and the lower Rappahannock. So if you'd stick to those points, and then we'll get as many as we can, but time's rolling on here. We've got a long agenda. Plus, I have to leave early.
I'm gonna keep
Roy, it. Good to see you.
Good to see you, sir. Appreciate the opportunity. You know, the old saying, the devil is in the details, and I think that is a situation here at hand. I'm speaking for the Virginia Watermen's Association, and there are others that will probably speak too, and some other people that I'm representing in the industry. And we're not here asking for anything contrary to the conservation of these oyster rocks. I agree with 90-some percent of what Roger Mann said and a lot of what Jim Weston said. Headed up the planning program here at BMRC for over 20 years, so you know, and I think that I was noted as one of the conservation-minded managers here at the agency. And when at times contrary to what the public wanted to uphold conservation. The fact of the matter is that the average age of watermen is 53 years old. It's an aging group of people. They cannot work. Men that age cannot work hand tongs any longer. We need to be able to harvest oysters with a more mechanized type gear so that these people can make a living. That is a fact. Can this be done and conserve the James River, for example, at the same time? Well, it just so happens that I was raised by a oyster family on both sides. A lot of their income was from the James. I have hand-tonged. I know specifically every rock in the James River personally, having left some sweat and tears and blood out there on those rocks. So nobody can tell me the details of the James River. Now, you can convince me on some of these other rivers and other rocks. But in the James River, you can allow the scraping of oysters on the north side of the James River, in the areas that's being scraped now, and you can go up in the James River Swash and on up to the reefs at Mulberry Island Point, and you will not hurt anything. If you follow the conservation measures in place and you scrape those with this 40-pound hand scrape, and you do it in the way that's being done now, you will not harm those oyster rocks on the north side of the river. As a matter of fact, in the Jail Island area, Jim Weston will probably attest to this, it's being silted over. And so, in using this in those flat areas, those flat sandy areas, you would pull the shells up that the state went to great expense to put there early on, that are being silted over. You would pull them up on top, and you would cleanse them so that they would be there for the setting of spat in the upcoming seasons and so forth. So, as I said, the devil is in the details. So you could allow that. Now, you go over in Pointer Shoals in those areas, Jim is right. I mean, it's knolly bottom, and there's a possibility that some of those small knolls might be pulled down. But here again, the watermen and their method of of using these dredges, they circle in a tight circle, around in a tight circle. They cull on top of the rocks. They have they buoy off the rocks. They work the rocks. And it wouldn't benefit them even to get off of these knolls or off of these rocks. So I question how much of this argument that they would pull the rocks down is a legitimate argument. But I know that on the north side of that river that you could use hand scrapes and you would not harm anything, and you would very possibly help on the north side. So that, to me, is not reasonable to keep these people from using the small dredge, at least in the James River Swash and on up on Jail Island. That for the James River. Now for a little history lesson, if Mr. Pruitt will let me speak for a few more minutes. In 1894, Captain Baylor's survey was completed, and statewide, the oyster rocks were put in a trust for the public use and harvest. And it was through the years, it came down here for VMRC to manage the public rocks. Now, in that language, it says that they are for the public use and harvest. Now, to me, that is good. And VMRC has done an excellent job, I think, of managing these rocks and so forth. But when you go to the Rappahannock River and you take from that bridge down between 5 and 7 miles to Stingray Point, and you take thousands of acres of oyster grounds and you say that that is a sanctuary, then to me you have gone contrary to the intent of the state constitution and the public oyster rocks. I'm not arguing against sanctuaries. I would be the first one to get up here and tell you that sanctuaries are important, and they are important, but they need to be placed in the right place so that you pick up the oyster larval flow and disbursement and so forth, and there's no data, no evidence that in that lower part of the Rappahannock River that is contributing to the upper part of the river. Now, we've held that out of production for over 15 years under the assumption that it is contributing to the upper part of the river. I think it would be more sound if we went in there and put a sanctuary that went up the middle of that river so that in this gyro effect that some of the oystermen have talked about that the tide pattern makes, that the oyster larvae is picked up and moved around in that river from the middle section of the river, as opposed to saying that the lower section of the river is contributing larvae to the whole river. What I'm telling you is my feeling that without having the support data for the lower part of the river, that we ought to reposition that sanctuary to be in the middle part of the river so that we are sure that we're getting some larval use or larval disbursement and use out of the placing of the sanctuary. Here again, you know, the devil is in the details. In the lower part of the Rappahannock River, there are flat rocks, and there are areas that you're not going to break through the surface, as has been explained here, that you break through the surface of the shells and you'll destroy these rocks. But in the lower part, in Parrish's Rock, in the lower part of the Rappahannock River, you are not going to break through. And, you know, the argument that you're going to destroy oyster rocks summarily with oyster dredges is not sound for several reasons. I mean, Lionel explained to you that it's been done on private beds for a long time. This light oyster dredge won't do that. Pocomoke Tangier Sound, I was the servant on the commission. They were dredging oysters in Pocomoke Tangier Sound with oyster dredge-sized dredges when I was on the commission, and maybe earlier than that, Bill. You probably remember when they first started dredging it there. But my point is that dredging does go on, and the oyster rocks replenish themselves, and where there is other means of conservation. What we are advocating
is a change in strategy here so that the oystermen can economically and socially survive here. We've come to the point that the season is scheduled to end now, at the end of this month. The oystermen desperately need a place to work. And when Jim Wesson, others, myself at one point, when we took on the responsibility of managing this public oyster fishery or these public fisheries, we took on the responsibility of trying to manage in a way that they, the fishermen and the oystermen could survive. And they need a break here. They need for you to be concerned about them and their families and the situation that we find ourselves in the dead of winter right here, that they have a place to work. And all we're suggesting is that you take 3 weeks to a month in the Lower Rappahannock, not all of it. Now, NOAA is arguing that that they have reseeded or replaced shells. They've only put shells on 150 acres of this Lower Rappahannock River. There are many more acres than that in the Lower Rappahannock that these people could be working. And if they work them using a strategy, that a sound management strategy, such that we're getting proper conservation, then it could be done. I mean, we're for conservation. Don't get me wrong. We're for sanctuaries. I'm for sanctuaries. I'm not for pulling these rocks down and destroying these rocks, and neither of these people behind me. But we are for managing in a way that supports and balances the public fishery with the private fishery in the state. And the way this thing is going, it's not being done. And we welcome what Jack is suggesting for a study. That's great. But we need some relief and some help this season, too. Thank you very much, Mr. Pruitt.
Thank you, Roy. Yes, sir, and then Doug, and then Dale.
Yes, sir, Mr. Pruitt. My name is Jody Kress. I'm just another dumb waterman. Don't have any PhDs. But I would like to make a few points. Number one, you want to talk about physics. That only weighs about 8 pounds on the bottom if it weighs 50 pounds in air. So you got a difference there. Maybe we can solve all the problems by teaching the oysters to read Mr. Mann's charts. I don't know. But the point I would like to make is everybody seems to have the attitude that we go in with these dredges and we completely wipe out everything. Well, that's not true. You take a dredge this size, maybe holds a bushel of everything, total growth. It gets down to 10, 12, 15 oysters, still marketable size, spawnable size oysters. We leave. We got to go on. It's not enough for us to make a profit. Oysters spawn millions per piece. If one oyster out of that 10 to 15 we leave per bushel, I mean, the whole thing on the Lower Rappahannock seems to be broodstock. If we leave one, if one of those oysters out of the 15 we leave, the salinity, as Mr. Mann said, it's all out of nature, trying to control nature. But if you're talking about a creature that spawns in the millions, if it's just that one oyster lives, you're talking about millions of spawn. Broodstock is not the problem, it's disease. The oysters below the Rappahannock Bridge are going to die. I will bet anything anybody wants to bet. We can step right here this time next year. Those oysters will be dead because of the stuff that's on them. If you don't work it up, they will die, period. I know it for a fact. I don't have 4,000 points of reference. I got about 4 million from where I made licks on an oyster bottom my whole life, as a lot of these other people do. It's just, it's a matter of passion. It's not a matter of money. We're part of the, we consider ourselves as watermen, as part of the resource. We get treated like we're out there to rape the resource. That's not the case. It's a matter of passion, just like farming to farmers. You are taking away our livelihood, is what you're doing. Yes, we're for conservation. It seems to me 20 years ago, most of what this council did made sense. The last 15 years, all the old knowledge has been thrown out the window. You got people running this thing. As far as I'm concerned, they're educated beyond their intelligence. And it's just not right. And to open them oyster reefs, it's not going to hurt anything. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Douglas?
Thank you, Commissioner Pruitt, members of the board, Doug Jenkins, Twin River Watermen Association. I thought I had my notes and everything all organized, but I've been taking down some notes, and now I don't know where to begin, but I'll begin somewhere. Had a little cute joke I wanted to tell you, but I don't want to tell you that now or at the end of remarks. Well, y'all tar and board there? You ready for a little lift?
Go ahead.
It's very... appropriate for this issue. It's a story was told of a father who had two young teenage sons, and one had a very pessimistic view, and one had a very optimistic view. So they came home from school one day, and he told them, he says, boy, says, after you get a little snack, says, I got each one of you a gift up in your room on your bed. And so they got their little snack and run up to the bedroom to see what Dad had got them. And he gave them about 15 or 20 minutes, and he went up to check on them. And he went in the bedroom where the pessimistic son was, and he'd open his box up, and he'd bought him some of these little battery-operated computer games. And he said, son, how you like your gift? He said, oh, Dad, says, I don't know. He said, the battery's going to go dead on these, and the things won't work. And he said, this one I'm playing with now, said the switch is getting stuck on it. So he knew that he hadn't pleased him. So he went over in the other bedroom, and the dad had boxed up a box of horse manure. And he opened his door, and the boy was laughing and carrying on and throwing that horse manure up in the air. He said, son, what in the world are you so happy about? He said, I'll tell you one thing. He says, if all this horse shit, there's bound to be a pony around here somewhere. So, we're looking for a little pony today. Heard a lot of pessimistic views. I thought y'all might need that late in the load.
You just had to top old Lionel, didn't you?
Yeah, I had to top Lionel. He's just a cousin back then. What I want to start off with is something that the advisory committee had recommended at the last Shellfish Advisory Committee, and it never got on this agenda, but I don't know whether it needs to, but I want to alert y'all on this because we're in late January, and February and March is going to be here, and that's time to move seed oysters out to James River and plant them in the Rappahannock and the tributaries of Potomac. And we recommend 100,000 bushels out of James River, which has approximately 900,000 bushels, so that's roughly one-tenth, not going to hurt that area in it. And we should be gearing up for that now. And if you don't need to advertise it for another month or anything, it means get show on the road. And just enlighten you, and degrading anybody here, but I want to give you a notice here that VMRC sent out in 2004 and how the replenishment has been working over the years. It's not Doug Jenkins' paper, it's y'all's paper. Here's a notice. For the 2004 oyster replenishment program, notice is hereby given that Virginia Marine Resources intends to transfer approximately 5,454 bushels of oysters, seed oysters, from the James River to the Nominee. And here's the plans. Approximate time for transplanting will be from 15th of March to the 31st of March, 2 weeks. All tonguing will be completed by 12 o'clock. You got a 4-hour work day in 2 weeks for the transplant, 5,454 oysters in. One contractor will be utilized for the transport and planting of seed orchards. The planter will be the contractor and will be responsible for transporting and planting the seed orchards in the receiving area. The planter will also be responsible for paying the harvester, and the total price per bushel is $5.50. That's 2004. That's why we're not getting any orchards up in that area, and you know what happened last year in the Rappahannock. I want to bring that to your attention. It's there in the paper, it's record, and I think the board members should know that. 2 weeks at a time, plant the horses and move them, give the tongs 4 hours to work to catch it. 550 bushel overboard. And we're in 2006 now. The next thing I want to touch on, since Dr. Mann didn't give you an answer, Dr. Jones, on the density of horses, he said it would take him a very long while, and I can sense that by the numbers he put down on the screen. We were going over, but I can give you a little background on the density of horses. Heavy density of horses is not good for spawning. Fat, healthy horses spawn if the water temperature and the salinity is right. And the reason for that is this. Horses are so thick that they are competing for food in the water column. Merlin scientists, and when they're competing for food in the water column, they don't get fat. Anybody who's had anything dealing with horses know that the horses are fat when there's not as many on the bottom, and they can filter the water and get more nutrients out of it. I don't have doctor's degree in science and arts, but I do have enough common sense to know that. I've been growing them and shucking them for a number of years, and I know my beds, when I had them too thick, they wouldn't be fat. Merlin scientists claim that an oyster rock can replenish itself with only 5% of the oysters left on it. And any rock out here that these waters working on it, they leave more than 5% on it, because when it gets down to that low number, they quit. I heard Noah speak in the Army Corps of Engineers, and any of you should have read, or if you didn't, I have a copy of the Virginia Pilot, where that reporter done a research over here. Over $8 million is spent on the oyster restoration with the Jim Weston and these others that thought this was a great idea to put the reeds and things out there. And 93% of that money has been wasted. No results of it. Now, that's a great bull pack, or track record, I would say. Dr. Jim Weston said 550,000 bushels of seed orange has been moved since 93. I know what happened to some of them. He planted, moved a lot of them, kept them closed till they died. And I came down here about 3 or 4 years ago and argued for getting some opens up in the Nominee. Some of y'all older members on the board remember that. Also gave some misleading information about the shells turning to the bottom regarding the hand drudging as compared to tonguing. All shells were turning to the bottom on the rock, whether they are working with tongs or dredges. The dredger stays on the rock, and if he picks the horses, it's markable at it. He returns the shells to the rock. He don't dredge on the rock and goes over there and call off. I mean, that doesn't happen. It doesn't work that way. They're a whole lot cleaner when they dredge. Any of you have docks been on the water lately? I want you to do a little test this summer. Throw a line overboard. Let it hang there all summer. Pull it up next fall and see what you got on it. If you put over a line the size of that pencil, it will be big as that mite by the end of the fall. How did it get that way? Allergy. Now, if you went out there and cleaned that line every so often, it wouldn't be that big, right? Same thing happens down on the bottom. We set crab pots. If we didn't put antifouling on it and dip on it, we never would be able to crab. We wouldn't be able to get them out the water. And I haven't been down there diving like Dr. Weston has, but he's trying to tell me that the bottom don't foul up, and he's in a different park than I am. Now, I know y'all had a long day. I'm going to give you my little short presentation. Did y'all get the graphs that I put out? Mr. Garrison, did you give everybody one? It shows that hand scraping in the Rappahannock is improving the bottoms. There's more small arches and fat on the area that's being worked and those that's not. We sort of look at that. Virginia Waterman Association would like you to approve the request made by the Shellfish Advisory Committee that is made up of watermen, processors, and other interest parties. The data collected by Jim Weston, the annual survey for the last 3 years, show arsenic rocks in the Rappahannock that are now worked are producing more arsenic than the ones below the Robert Norris Bridge. These rocks have been closed since 1992. 14 years of study and research has proven that Virginia will never have a successful replenishing program under its present policy. Reefs placed in shallow water work like groins, causing sand and shells to cover the arsenic rocks over. And this has happened in the Cone and the Great Yukamaka. Some of those rocks, Baylor Survey rocks, are in 4, 5, and 6 feet of water. And they've put groins, reefs on them that's acting like groins to the top of the water. And the wakes from the boat traffic are covering our Baylor Survey ground up. That's a detrimental use of funds. It's not helping anything, it's harming. And we want that to stop. Watermen have been patient for a long time, but time is running short. We will not stand by and see a natural resource ruined by people who do not know what they are doing and fail to listen to sound, common sense advice that has proven to work. We are only asking for 50% of the arsenic rocks below the ridge be open in a small area in the James River. Please honor our request. Commissioner Pruitt, you appointed the new Shellfish Advisory Committee for a good reason. Are you going to let it function as it should, or will it go back to dictatorship like it's been for a number of years? Thank you, sir. Any questions?
A lot of that will depend on whether you come to the meeting. Before the Shellfish Committee on the Bayside phased itself out because nobody came to the meeting. On the seaside, it stayed in existence and still in existence. Now we're back to doing that. Yes, the answer is we're going to. Yeah, you heard what Jack said earlier. That's where that's going to come from. The recommendations will come from that committee. The Crab Committee functions. The Finfish Committee functions. So I don't see why that won't function.
Yeah.
Thank you, Doug.
Yeah.
All right, Dale. I think after Dale, we'll just have a show of hands, because I think we're repeating each other right now quite a bit. So I'll let Tommy speak on... And then after Tommy, we'll have a show of hands, and that'll be it. Dale, good to see you.
See you, Mr. Pruitt. I'm Dale Taylor, president of the Virginia Waterman Association. I've heard, about demo, and disease, from a good doctor, and it looks like that the waterman is not killing the oyster business. It looks like the disease is killing it. So the drudges has got nothing to do with what's going to be, what's dying. Disease is killing it, the oysters out there today. And if we don't get a chance to work these rocks, then the disease might come back stronger and they might die again. And that'd be 15 more years we'll have to wait. I don't think nobody can really tell at this time what's going to happen to the oyster rocks. But I believe they need working. And I don't think none of us in here today is going to know when they're going to die or when they're going to come back and we have all the oysters you want. But you talk about private, a gentleman got up and talked about the private raising oysters. I don't think there's enough private oyster growers in here can run one shucking house with 20 shuckers. You can't do it. So we're going to have oyster houses depending on private people raising the oysters, or the private people are going out and selling them, and they want to have the market. Not the watermen, but the people are raising these oysters. Everybody knows how to raise oysters today. We hear it all the time. And some living, some not. I got a man that's raising oysters right down below me, right at the, I can 100 yards from me. He gets dumped all of his overboard. I think he's got one float left. There was a 10. Well, that shows me that they're not doing too good, and they are covered over with all kinds of grass and different things. But the waterman, I want to stress again, the waterman has not killed the oysters. Disease has killed them, like the doctor has said just now. Went through it over and over again about the disease. That ought to tell you all that the waterman is not doing it. It should tell every one of you that we need to work them. There's a lot of watermen here, and I respect them to be here today. They come here with their hearts open, their minds open, hoping they can get some work to do and carry them through January. I ask the commission to open the rocks in the lower Rappahannock in the James, at least open it through January. That's 4 weeks, 5 weeks. Open it right away. Give them that time. 4 weeks is not going to hurt anybody. The time they get on the rocks and get out there, it will help the commission. It will help them. It will help everybody to find out what is down there, if there's any oysters dead, how many is dead, how many is alive, and if they can make 4 weeks work. They might not. But you look around you today, you see these watermen here, that shows you that they want to work. They need work. And I'm asking you, the commission, to find a way to make this work and let them have at least 4 weeks and find out what's going on in these rubbers. We'd like to have more, but we ask you that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dale. Tommy?
My name's Tommy Leggett with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. We support the staff recommendation. In particular, the Bay Foundation has been a partner with the Oyster Heritage Program. We have gardeners who have planted oysters in the Rappahannock who are growing oysters. Our own oyster farm has put oysters in the Rappahannock, so we do support maintaining that area as a closed area. We just don't feel like it's quite ready for opening up and sustain a sustained harvest. That's it.
Thank you, Tommy. Those of you that come down here today, you've heard the presentations from the public and also from staff. You know the staff recommendation to keep everything as it is, and then the request is to open the lower Rappahannock and the upper part of the James. What those of you who are opposed to the staff recommendation, you can stand up just to show us that you came, what you came down here for. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, those of you that came here, okay, thank you all very much. And those that are...
Commissioner Pruitt, when in a number of phone calls and requests from the county board...
We got a letter.
They're in the record. Okay. Yeah. Got a letter from Delegate Whitman. Got a letter of Westmoreland County Board of Supervisors, for example. Yes, they're all in the record that came in. Anyone here that supports the staff recommendation that came for that purpose and didn't get a chance to speak or didn't want to speak or did speak, you can stand up. All right. Well, thank you all. Thank you all again for coming. Appreciate it very much. All right. We're going to now close the public hearing and put this matter to the commission.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Garrison.
I've been looking at this thing a long time, and I'm not opposed to opening up a portion. I'd like to see that map back up there, Dr. Weston, if I could, on the Rappahannock. Please, and while he's doing that, I'll give you a little background. A lot of people in this country, what's made this country great, have changed jobs. I started out with being a cotton farmer, picking cotton by hand. I ended up building roads, so... Don't be afraid. What I'm trying to tell you in a nice way that the recommendations, as far as I'm concerned, as long as I'm a member of this commission, won't be made on your livelihood. There are many, many opportunities in this great country of ours to do other things. And I would not be sympathetic with the baby's milk or whatever, or my car broke down. That's my position.
And if it changes, I can't help about the diseases and the different things that happen. It happens, if you remember, we had rockfish in the 50s. They left. We had bluefish and we had trout. They left. We got rockfish back. And we have to have limits established by the feds and us together and most of the feds. But we have no control over that. So your profession is not, you know, our fault if they're 400 licenses when they were 2,600. I remember all that and worked with them out there. But don't be afraid to look at other ventures. I did. I understand where, but I want you to say we're not basing on that. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
Thanks. Well, there's your map. There's your chart.
All right, the map there is from back. Is Dr. Weston, could you put a hypothetical line from that line there to Mill Creek, from Mosquito Point to Mill Creek? That's okay. I'd like to make a motion that area from Mosquito Point to Mill Creek be open for 30 days with the small dredge not to exceed 50 pounds in weight the month of February, and start the 1st of February and end the end of February, 28 days for that small dredge only.
Which side of the line you just drew?
Put the light back on Mill Creek, Jim.
Mill Creek is right here. Across the
line. See the line he's drawing?
Yeah.
He's asking you which side of that line.
Which side of the line, left or right?
Left side, the north bridge side.
Between there and the bridge.
Between there and the bridge.
That gives you three or four rocks to work out there. The reason for that motion is gives staff and you some ideas of what might be there or might not be there. Above the bridge, you've cleaned up pretty clean. Behind that line that Jim just drew, you still have an area there that hadn't been dredged since 1992.
Let me see if I get a second to that. Second to the motion? Is there a second to the motion?
I'll second it for discussion purposes.
Seconded by Mr. Baden for discussion purposes. Right now, discussion to the motion. Mr. Robbins.
Just to be clear, Mr. Chairman, this area is in the sanctuary. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. At this point, I would just like to back up and say that I think a lot of good points were made on both sides of this issue by all the speakers today. One thing I heard loud and clear was that we do need to get everybody together and reevaluate our management strategy in Virginia. And I think staff, I appreciate the fact that staff has been willing to bring that idea to the table. I think that's a necessary step forward. Oyster management in Virginia is certainly a complex issue. But I think this, as Dr. Weston pointed out earlier, that this affects more than just Virginia. There is a substantial partnership at work in this area, in the area of oyster replenishment, specifically in the Rappahannock. A multi-million-dollar investment has been made on a good faith basis, and I think it's incumbent on this commission to basically manage that in a way that's appropriate and prudent. And I don't think we can abandon the sanctuary unless it's been shown to be a failure. It's a central component of our management strategy in that area. Dr. Weston has testified that the oyster abundance in that area is at too low of a level, basically at 5 per meter or something on that order, to guarantee any natural recruitment in the area. So I don't think it would be appropriate to open the area, and I'm not able to support the motion.
Mr. Baden.
This is a bad seat. I wish I was still in school. I'd have to be excused. I understand the plight of the waterman. I am a waterman. My family's been watermen before Virginia was ever a state. I mean, my relatives, I have 300 years of them buried within 5 minutes of my house. But what you might be doing is trading today for all your tomorrows. I mean, you're taking a chance at that. So my main concern is James River. That I don't think there's no compromise whatsoever on that. That is a seed area. It's been showed, topographical charts and stuff. We know the contour of the bottom. On the Rappahannock, I won't want to take a chance on making the partners aggravated and withdraw from the program, because there, where would we be? We'd have no funding, because most of the funding comes from the partners. Very little bit comes from the state. I could see maybe opening a small area on a trial, but Mr. Garrison's talking about well over half the area is sanctuary. I don't know exactly how large that is because, you know, I'm not familiar with the area, but
not half the area.
We're talking a very large area. So, you know, I could be sympathetic for a small area, for to try something to see, more or less as a test. You harvest it, leave it alone, and see what it comparison between that and the on harvest right next to each other, adjacent to each other. Because as you pointed out earlier, just like in the James River, the upper end is definitely unique from the lower end. And you may have the same characteristics in the Rappahannock. Being above the bridge might be unique from the lower bridge, but I mean, that's such a large area. And to address what Doug said, and I think it should be part of this too, is we do need to move seed. We brought this up before. We have places in the Potomac that probably would be very good growing areas unless you get a fresh out and that would kill them, but it would increase the chance of survival up there, and they would grow much better and they could be harvested. But right now, I could support a smaller amount, but Mr. Garrison, I just couldn't support this larger area because I don't want to take a chance on trading all of our futures for what could happen today. I think, you know, we need to be very careful.
Thank you, Dr. John.
It's hard to be third when you've had two people be so eloquent.
How about it?
And there's not a lot I can add to it. I agree with my colleagues. I wanted to address an issue of a statement that was made. And again, a lot of good points were made, pro and con. And one of the statements made was that VMRC is taking away the commercial watermen's livelihood. And that's not true. To a certain extent, disease has taken away oysters, but when we think about commercial fisheries in general, what's destroying the livelihood is the long-term neglect of the health of the Chesapeake Bay by the citizens in its watersheds, not by VMRC. We've tried to make decisions that will give both short and long-term benefits, trying to balance the livelihoods of people who make an honest and honorable living, mostly, with long-term gain to your children and your grandchildren. And I think that's foremost in our minds.
Thank you, Dr. Jones. Any comments to the motion on this end? Mr. Robbins?
Mr. Chairman, at this point, I would offer a substitute.
Substitute
would be to approve staff recommendations that no further areas be opened to oyster harvest by hand scraping in the lower Rappahannock or the upper James, with two additions to that. One would be an extension of the lower James River season for one more month from February 1 through February 28. And the second addition would be that within 90 days, the commission would convene a workshop for the purposes of reviewing the goals and strategy of Virginia's oyster management strategy.
Is there a second to the substitute? Second by Dr. Jones.
I'll second that. In addition, if you'd take a friendly amendment, I think one of the things I'd like them to explore is how to help the watermen in the short term through perhaps approaching the legislature.
Indeed.
Would you repeat what you said?
Yeah.
I didn't quite. I don't think we heard
you.
Hear
me. I did not hear.
Mine?
I didn't hear you.
Oh, I added an amendment that one of the topics that would be explored is how, through perhaps approaching the legislature, that Virginia could help the watermen in the short term.
Okay. That's part of your motion.
Yes, sir.
Substitute. All right. Any discussion to the substitute? All right. We're prepared to vote on the substitute first. All in favor of the substitute motion, raise your right hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Opposed, same sign. 1. Substitute motion carries. The James River and the Rappahannock will remain closed this year. However, we will get the panel going as soon as possible. All right, Mr. Bowden.
I think one thing we need to address, we addressed it before, it's not been addressed this time, is the seed movement. And evidently, there's severe restrictions.
I mean, we're having a replenishment meeting on February 9th. It's all set up. And we have to go through a replenishment process. So
and you're willing to change.
It's already been scheduled.
Yeah, February 9th. And I would invite any commission member who wants to attend that to see that in action. You're welcome to attend.
Can I ask Mr. Weston a question along those lines?
Yes, indeed.
Are you willing to change restrictions and stuff through this procurement process, or do you want to keep the current restrictions in place? For example, a four-hour work day to two-week period.
I mean, that we set the time period according to how much we have to do. I mean, it's not a four-hour time period. When we work with bi-boats and they need to get out of the river by a certain time period, the watermen start at daybreak, so it's more than 4 hours. They end up having a full load, and they're ready to quit. They quit most mornings 10 or 11 o'clock anyhow.
You can get that work out. I need to come in.
Yeah, I mean, we work with the watermen. That we just try to get the bi-boats on moving before the day is too far along.
All right. Thank you all. And now we'll go back to item 7. It means that no change. They did not approve what you asked for. Oh, what you've been doing this season.
Part of the motion was to extend the season in the James River an additional month.
Yeah, Mr. Robinson.
No problem with that. No, hold on a minute. Let me answer that question.
The Rappahannock closes at the end of this month.
But you're going to, the season has been extended for a month.
In the James.
In the James, the season has been extended for a month. Was that a request, too?
That was not part of the motion that passed.
No.
Okay. You're not willing to say.
When does Rappahannock
end? Rappahannock closes the end of this month, the end of January.
At the pleasure of the commission?
Question for Mr. Weston.
All right, Doc. Mr. Bowden.
You might as well stay right up here, Jim. I'm going to worry you to death. We know the particulars of the James River. Can you give us some? I understand why he suggested the James, not the Rappahannock. Is there a reason that you want to keep the Rappahannock season closing at the same time?
No spat set in the Rappahannock, no recruitment. We've got recruitment sufficient enough to carry us forward in the James. And most of the comments I've heard from the watermen were that they thought it was done.
Basically, they're in the same situation that Tangier and Pocomoke's in.
Yeah.
Where they have
been longer. I mean, there was an article in the paper where they're just getting one or two oysters per lick in some areas. So.
All right, I'm going to have to end it. That's the decision of the commission. I'm sorry. It'd be the best we could. All right, item 7, Tracy.
Okay.
All right, how's the new man? How's your new boss?
Great job.
How's he?
Did you announce?
I didn't announce. I'm going to wait for the lead. I told him that I'm available to do other work to get the transition updated on that project.
Okay.
Anyways, no, I'm very
That's good. I'm not going to be here in February. All right. Okay. But I will be here in March. Hope.
Yeah, I might not be here in February. Check.
Tracy, we'll continue whenever I get rid of the commissioner.
Yes, sir.
Bye, Bill. Tracy, item 7, Tanner's Landing.
Yes, sir. Tanner's Landing Associates, LLC, requests authorization to install a 363 linear foot by 8-foot wide open pile community pier with 10 slips, 6 uncovered lifts and associated finger piers, and to dredge 825 cubic yards of state-owned submerged lands to reach minus 5 within a 130-foot by 210-foot basin to serve a 27-unit condominium complex adjacent to the Granby Street Bridge and the Lafayette River in Norfolk. The agent is protesting the assessment of a royalty in this case. Mm-hmm. Kathy, let's go right to the slides, please. Thank you. This project was presented to the commission last month as a page 2 item. Staff was recommending approval at that time. We continue to recommend approval of this project. In accordance with the revised rent and royalty schedule, which became effective December 1st, 2005, staff recommended that royalties be collected for the dredging and for the encroachment. Mr. Tom Langley, agent for the applicant, spoke during the comment period for page two items last month and objected to the assessment of the royalty. As a result, the commission tabled this item, requesting that staff bring it back this month for further consideration. I'll go ahead and run you through the project real quick just so that you're familiar with what we're talking about. The project is located here. This is the Lafayette River. Here, if you're familiar with Norfolk at all, this is Colonial Place. Again, this is a 2002 aerial. Again, just to orient you to the project, this is the parcel that we're talking about here, the Granby Street Bridge, and a staff aerial, which I just took last week. You can see the project is well underway with drive-in pilings and associated work with the construction of the condominiums. The pier is supposed to be approximately this alignment,